So let me start from recapping briefly what we did last time. I will be short, and then we will start with the new topic on of the world entropy. Well, first compute, then the ingredients that we need in GR, the neutral current, and so on, and then we will use them to start discussing the world entropy. So in GR, we have our field space, of course, is the space of matrix on spacetime. And the action that we look at is the Einstein-Hilbert action that I write in natural unit as r minus 1 half lambda v for x. So later on, lambda will be set to 0, but most of what I will say before we start talking about the world entropy will be valid for all signs of the cosmological constant. The equations of motion are with these type of with these conventions, EAB will be. Okay, this is a little confusing here. So this is minus GAB plus lambda GAB epsilon, and theta I don't have the updated file, so unfortunately my signs, I thought I had updated the file, so I'm not sure about the signs of this. So this is GAB minus delta A delta G. And there is a 1 half in front and an epsilon. Okay.
Speaking, if I take the variation of the action
yeah.
with the 1 half if you have that you have there, I'm getting a different factor in AIB for lambda. Should it be maybe minus 2 lambda?
Ah, sorry, I put the 1 half on the wrong place. Of course. Yeah. Better? Which makes sense with these 1 half because it depends on one. Good. So one small remark is that now this volume density is square root of g delta 4 of x, but this delta, this square root of g now depends on my field. So if I take variations of it, this will not be 0. Whereas in all previous examples, epsilon was going in and out of the variations with no problem. Our symmetry algebra is the algebra of diffeomorphisms, which is the algebra of vector fields. And the variation of the metric is by Lie derivative. I emphasize that this is not a change of coordinates. It really has to be understood as a change in the metric of as a field configuration. Now the important point where I stopped last time was to emphasize that background independence or general covariance can be encoded into this equation. So we take the Lagrangian density, which is what is inside this integral. And if we vary it in field space along a diffeomorphism, what we get is nothing else than the Lie derivative of the density of that quantity. As a form of spacetime here on the right-hand side, and as a function on field space on the left-hand side. That's the difference. And I stress that this was not true, for example, for the scalar field Lagrangian that we had, because there we really needed to use a background metric, which was the, I don't know, Minkowski metric, even though it could have been written in arbitrary coordinates. So in a way, the action was invariant under changes of coordinates. It's not invariant in this sense, because there the field space action would not have acted on the metric, which is a background fixed structure that of which we don't look at the dynamic. And so this equation would have failed. Questions about that? We're going to use it now to compute the Hamiltonian flow equation for GR. Anything? No? Okay. So if we do this, for example, what happens is that if you look, remember, recall, to compute the Noether current, the Noether current is given by the contraction of theta with the diffeomorphism, so the evaluation of theta over a diffeomorphism variation, if you want, minus R psi, where these R is how much the Lagrangian varies along the symmetry. So where dr of psi is by definition this. This is true for any theory. Now, using general covariance here, or background independence maybe, what we know is that this change is just the lead derivative. Yes?
Yeah, I might have a question about background independence. So if I write my G mu nu as some background plus a fluctuation, and I promote the fluctuation to be my field, then this equation wouldn't hold for the fluctuation?
Well, it depends how the fluctuation transforms. If you reabsorb this entire transformation on the fluctuation, it's fine. You're just using, so if you write, for example, let me write it here, GAB equal eta AB plus HAB, and this is not small in any way, and delta H is given by that covariant derivative with respect to the full metric, so it's a nonlinear change, then it's fine. You're just changing coordinate on field space, in a sense. You're using H, which is G minus eta, instead of something else. It's not super... Yeah. So if you want to have the space of metrics, and you're picking one, and you're saying a metric over here, I think I coordinatize it as by how far it is from eta.
Yeah.
You could do that. It's not necessarily the most natural thing, but at that level there wouldn't be a problem.
But I could still consider linearized gauge invariance, right?
In that case, you would not get that.
It wouldn't work,
No, because then it's a scalar field. It's coordinate independent, but it's not background independent in that way.
But on the left hand side, I would vary H, right? And on the right hand side, I would get linearized gauge transformation, and it wouldn't be equal.
Well, probably only if you take your Lagrangian to be, if you truncate also the Lagrangian, maybe up to some, it will be valid up to some order in the perturbation.
Yeah.
But I don't expect it to be valid. Exactly.
All right. So I have to change my Lagrangian, and then it would look like it's become independent. But
Sorry.
It would look like it's become independent only if I change my Lagrangian. That's basically.
Only if you. I'm not sure I...
You truncated the Lagrangian.
If you truncate it and you truncate the transformations, I also wonder whether you automatically find terms of higher order, which are not sim, which you if and which will be. So when you take the variation of the Lagrangian along the symmetry, you want the boundary term. Some of these objects might not be boundary terms because they are higher order, and to be bound, they would be higher order if you were perturbing both your symmetry and your metric one order beyond. So you have to truncate everything consistently. So I think it's what I haven't done it, but I would expect that if you keep H as your first order perturbation and you use the linearized version of these, then and you truncate your Lagrangian to quadratic order, then things might go through up to corrections which are cubic in H and Xi and so on. That's my expectation. I haven't done the exercise to check. So here, now we know that this is the Lie derivative. And the Lie derivative using Cartan's formula has two pieces. One is trivially zero, and the other one is this one. The one that is trivially zero is this other one, because D of a top form vanishes, right? So this is identically zero. So we are left with this object, which is indeed a boundary term. So I can choose my R to be given by IXIL. So this is non-zero. This is different from what happened, for example, in Young-Mills. Is more similar to what happens to the scalar field in when I look at time translation symmetry. OK, with this and theta, I can compute J. This is a bit of a computation. I use this formula over here. Now I have the two ingredients. And I want to write this. Remember, when we had the local symmetry, J was split naturally into a bulk term, which vanishes on shell, and a boundary term, which is is the rest of the Noether current. So I want to write it as psi b c. Okay, here one has to be a little bit careful. Let's write it properly. CA, CB, CA plus DB, GBA. Psi. So these are what will be the term that vanishes on shell. So this guy is nothing else than twice the equations of motion, and indeed vanishes on shell. And what remains after the computation, one finds that this is 1/2 of this. So there we had a plus, here we have a minus. So this is antisymmetric in A and B, and indeed can be understood as codimension 2 form, like a top minus 2 differential form. So we can write, if you want, J as Xi B C B plus D of J, with J being 1/2, this J in the tensorial version times my top minus 2 form. So this is antisymmetric in my top indices. So this object here is called uh, is named after Comar, who found this formula first and discussed the meaning of this in the case of to study angular momentum and so on. The modern understanding is a bit more sophisticated, but this expression still goes under his name. This was a work done in the 50s, so very early on. This J can be written geometrically, maybe a bit more nicely as one stop. Well, I don't know if it is more nicely, but just to make clear that this is a top minus two form, you can say this is xi flat. If you remember, this means taking down the index and considering a vector as a one form, is the dual one form. Then you take d of it, which is this anti-symmetrized derivative, and then you make the star to get a top minus two form. So this is also an alternative way of writing it. It's not necessarily much more useful, but it's an intrinsic way to write this in form language. Now, concerning CAB, the projection of this CAB on the surface, or if you want, the pullback of this form over, oops, what is it? So if I take N, B, C, B, A, these we said were the constraints, and these are the, well, in a way, this gives you the constraints evaluated as sigma. And we will come back to this later, so I will not spend much time here. But this is the diffeomorphism. There are four of them for four indices. There is the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the NN one. And then the other three are the diffeomorphism constraints. So if you heard about them, if not, we will come back to them later. Okay, now we turn towards, we have all the ingredients to look at the Hamiltonian flow equation. And here, instead of doing a brute force computation, I want again to use general covariance as a tool to see what comes out. It's not really an Hamiltonian flow, as we will see. So what we want to compute is how much what is the obstruction to this equation to be true. So I just call the obstruction S and just compute S. So by this is, if you want, a definition of what S is the difference between these two quantities. The obstruction S can be rewritten as follows. So just by rearranging the terms appearing here, I can rewrite this as the lead derivative of theta minus delta r. So this is a one form in field space and a d minus four, top minus one form over spacetime. So this is in top minus one, one. Okay, so and you see why I want to do it like this, because here I have a lead derivative, and by background independence I can rewrite this nicely in terms of the spacetime lead derivative of theta. So this is a general formula. Again, using background independence, I find that this is L xi of theta minus delta r. And delta r was given to me over there. This is just I xi of L. Okay, so now I just do a couple more steps. Here I can use my my formula for my Cartan's formula for the lead derivative, and so this is ixi d theta plus d ixi theta. And then here I can take the d, the delta inside, and vary L. And here I hope that my my signs are working all right. So here I get the plus ixi. So what is delta L? Delta L was E minus d theta. Right? So this was, this is delta L. And now I see that one of these terms cancels. So ixi d theta, ixi d theta cancel. So this cancels with that. And I'm left with d ixi theta. Well, actually, let me write it like this. Ixi e plus d ixi theta. So let me summarize. Ixi turns out to be this. And the interesting thing is that, as expected, on shell, this is a pure boundary term. This was one of the theorem we had proved in full generality. So here we can just check that this is the case. These are the... Now let's look at the same formula now integrated over a Cauchy surface sigma. What do we find? We find sigma minus delta q sigma psi plus, and here we get these terms. So we have a bulk term over sigma, which is given by ixi e, plus a boundary term over the corner, if we have one, which is ixi theta. OK, I want to, oops, I forgot, did I? Oh, no, it's all right. So a couple of comments about this formula, and then we can move on. If you look at the computations we did for the scalar field, you remember we had the scalar field and space-time translations for the scalar field. These were Killing symmetry, so not quite the same setup, but still it was about certain diffeomorphism and how, to which extent there were symmetries of in this setup. When we computed this type of equation, in that case, we had a term like this. And if you remember, the conclusion was that the time translations were not symmetries of shell. You had to take into account the equations of motion to see that these were symmetry of the phase space. Because there was exactly a term like this, and this term over here is in fact proportional to NA psi. So this is equations of motion, and then it's multiplying psi A epsilon A. And if you look at what this is, this is equations of motion, psi A and A times the volume form on sigma. So it's only the normal piece of psi that enters here. So there's something about diffeomorphism in the time directions, which is complicated off shell. This will be reflected in the algebra of constraint that I mentioned before, and it's a topic for next time. Now we will go for next week. Now we will go on shell. And so this will not be a problem because on shell, this term disappears and so on. But if we wanted to work off shell, over an off shell phase space, and we would have to deal with this. This last term is also interesting. It's there only if we care about corners for some reason. And its interpretation, if you want, is the following. So suppose I have my hypersurface sigma over here, like this, whatever it is. And I have my subregion sigma, which now is a region with boundaries. Otherwise, I don't have the corner. So if I look at the causal development of these, let me say it slightly differently. This term is about, I draw this instead of in perspective, I draw it as a, as a cut. So this is sigma, and these are the boundaries of sigma. The first term is about changing a little bit my surface up and down. On shell, whatever happens on this surface is related to what happened on that other one, because I can just use the equations of motion to evolve my degrees of freedom from here to there or towards the past. It doesn't matter. It's a deterministic system a priori, so there's no problem. So on shell, I can deform my surface without losing much, in fact, any information. That's why on shell, there is no problem there. Now, this term does not go away when I go on shell. It's still there. But what is this term about? This term is about really changing the system that I'm looking at. Because this allows me to modify my surface anywhere inside the causal diamond, the causal domain of sigma, without losing any information. But if I'm changing this at the corner in the transverse direction, because this, a bit like here, this is non-trivial only if xi is transverse to sigma, this requires xi transverse non-zero if xi is transverse to partial sigma. Here, if I move around my corner like that, what I'm doing is really modifying the subsystem I'm looking at. It's not anymore the same subsystem. So intuitively, I expect that this is a very non-trivial operation. And so the fact that I cannot get the symmetry or order is because this type of transformation, morally speaking, is modifying the region I'm looking at. So I don't really expect these to encode symmetries unless something special is going on. So for example, what could happen is that I'm imposing some boundary conditions at the corners. So I restrict the kind of behavior my system can have there. And then maybe there is an easy relationship between what is happening here and there. And this can be reabsorbed somewhere else. So this is a maquette. It's not really what is going on. But I think it's a way to understand why this object is there, a way to deal with it in some cases is to impose boundary conditions. So here I want to add, because that's what will happen in this walled example, if boundary conditions are imposed at the time-like boundary, so or at the corner at any rate. At this boundary, maybe this term can be rearranged and reabsorbed somewhere else. But you see, a boundary condition is something that changes the field space I'm looking at. I'm not looking at all possible metrics. I'm looking at metric with some special property. And then I use this special property to manipulate this quantity. And maybe it turns out that over this subset of metrics, this is in fact a total derivative, a total variation, sorry. So it's a special property of what is going on in that particular scenario. It's not a general. A general situation. Questions? Now, otherwise I will kind of change gears and start talking about horizons and black holes. Okay. I see some perplexed faces over there. So now the idea is to think, okay, if I have a stationary black hole, then as I will explain in a moment, there is a privileged vector field in the story, which is a vector field which has this form. It's a time-like vector field at infinity. Plus omega h times phi. So this is time translations at infinity. This is rotations at infinity. And then I have a very special Killing vector field, which mixes the two with the prefactor, which is the velocity at which the black hole is rotating, physically speaking. And this vector field, as I will now explain, has a very special role. Now, the question is, what happens to this equation when evaluated on that vector field? And the idea is that from this delta q, I can get maybe delta of energy and a delta of angular momentum, because this is the charge associated to time translations and rotations. And if you write something like delta E plus omega delta j, this looks a lot like the first law of black hole mechanics. And so here you would expect to see also T delta S, the entropy, or if you want, kappa delta the area, which is the same as we will discuss. So the idea is to try to understand if this formula is hiding the first law of black hole mechanics somewhere and understanding exactly how this happens. But this is the heuristics. There is a special vector field on a black on a stationary black hole spacetime, and the charge delta q, roughly speaking, will give us delta e, delta j, and in this combination, this is exactly what appears in the first law. Now one has to explain why omega is outside, so there are lots of details to be fixed, where these other terms come from. But that's what we're going after. But before I have to explain where that vector field is. So I'm following a review by Wald about the black holes, horizons, and so on. Which is quite nice. And it's a review from 1999. Wald, which is called something like thermodynamics and quantum gravity. I don't remember, but it's a review. It's a review paper by Wald on, I think, CQG. Okay, now let's start with the definition. What is a Killing horizon? This is an extremely general definition, which is very useful in the study of GR. And a Killing horizon K is a null surface with a particular property whose generator L, whose null generator L is a Killing vector field. So then, this is called the Killing horizon. What is the picture we have in mind? We have in mind a null surface. So I can draw it like this. This is a portion of a null surface. And there are is generated in the null direction, right, by by this vector field LA, which generates it like this. L squared is 0. And we want, we want this L to be the evaluation on the surface of a Killing vector field. So this means then when I look it from the outside, this L, which is generating the null surface over there, outside it will look like this. You know, locally it's like a boost generator, essentially. It's a Killing, a local Killing, and is the evaluation of a Killing at the surface itself. So this is my Killing chi, and at L, this null surface becomes L. So you see an example of a Killing horizon is the Rindler horizon. So there's no gravity even involved. It's a geometric definition of a null surface with a particular property. Now I want to make a particular remark. Null surfaces are weird. A little weird. L is tangent to sigma, to kappa, and is also normal to it. How is that possible? What does it mean to be normal to a surface? It means that the inner product of L with all vector fields tangent to that surface is 0. So here there are the vector fields, the transverse one like this, and V and L have 0 inner product. But of course, L and L is also 0. And so L is normal to itself. So L has this odd property of being tangent and normal to the surface. This creates some confusion sometimes, so it's good to have these in mind. OK, now once you have a Killing horizon, you can define its its surface gravity. So you know you have this kA, which is this Killing, and chi a at kappa becomes 0 by definition. And so it means that dA of chi b of the norm. So this is 0 on kappa. So it means that it must be this quantity must be proportional to kappa itself, because it only changes in the normal direction. Well, so we call the proportionality constant minus 2 kappa. So this implies that these are proportional, and we are calling the proportionality constant kappa, and this is the surface gravity of the horizon. Another way to compute it is the following. One can show that the acceleration of the sky at the horizon, not everywhere, at the horizon is kappa times Ka. So it's a geodesic, it's an algeodesic with acceleration kappa. Yeah?
Is the surface gravity constant?
Yeah, it will be, that's a theorem. So, which I will mention in a second. So this is an algeodesic at kappa of acceleration, little kappa. So sorry that there are so many k's involved. This is a calligraphic k, this is the Greek kappa. So I will come back. Well, in fact, is what am I saying? Yeah, so it is constant. Now I'm a bit confused how much one needs the Einstein's equation for to deduce the fact that it's constant. I don't know. I'm not sure in which situation it's constant on shell. I think you need Einstein's equation somehow to. So that has to be checked. It's explained in Wald. I don't have it in mind, but if you wonder what. It will be constant, but I don't know if it is a non shell statement. I think it is. So now with this, what. So why am I talking about killing horizon is because they enter the geometry of black holes. So now I want to say a few words about black holes. So what is, do we all know what is a black hole? Have you already seen a general definition? I will rephrase, recall it, but have you seen it before? Or so. A black hole is defined in a bit of an odd way. You need to. So you need to say lambda is equal to zero, first of all. Not one can modify this, but for what we are concerned, you consider lambda equal to zero. And then you consider all the light rays that are able to go out to infinity, and you say that the black hole is the region, the complementary region of where these light rays are coming from. That's a rough idea. So it's the region out of which you cannot escape by construction. So with this hypothesis, technically one starts by introducing asymptotically flat spacetime. And this allows one to, one has the concept of future asymptotic null infinity. Future asymptotic null infinity. And in these diagrams, it looks like follows. Okay, let me just finish it in this. So what is this? Is the null infinity means that the place where light rays go in the infinite future, essentially. Whatever the place light rays go in the infinite future. Well, asymptotic future. Okay. So this can be made precise. And now if I look, the black hole B This is the interior of the black hole, if you want. The black hole region is my spacetime minus the past of scribe plus. So the picture is the following. I'm using Penrose Penrose conformal diagrams. So we don't really care what's happening here in the past. We don't care. But in the future, we have, so light rays in these diagrams move at 45 degrees. And those that move towards the right are moving out to infinity. So this is scribe plus, is where light rays go to die in the infinite future. Now, not all light rays will reach infinitely far away. Some of them will be trapped inside some region of my spacetime. And this is the black hole region in this diagram. This is where the singularity sits. And this is simply, so if you're looking at something very far away, we're somewhere close to infinity here. We're looking inside, and this is all we can see by looking backwards in time. This area is inside something that we cannot see because light cannot escape from it. So this is the rough meaning of this diagram. And now, black hole interior or region. And now, what is the horizon? The horizon is the boundary of the black hole. So it is this one. It's this surface here, and it's a non-surface. So I'm happy to, outside of the lecture, to give a few more details about this, if you're curious, but it would take too much time.
So black holes are defined from the boundary?
Exactly. So black holes are defined in a teleological way, which means you need to know the entire history of the universe in a way to say where the black hole is. They're defined from infinite future, from the infinite future looking backwards. A priori, there could be regions here on the horizon where absolutely nothing is happening. They are completely flat, Riemann flat regions of spacetime. So if you have a collapsing shell by Birkhoff theorem, inside the shell you can have Minkowskian geometry, so flat, complete flat. But if this shell is collapsing in a certain way to form a black hole, so it's something that has this is my shell, my collapsing shell. Inside the shell, this is really Minkowski. So there is no way to do a local measurement there and determine that there will be a horizon. So you don't know if you are inside a black hole, in a sense. You cannot know. What happens once you're inside is that you cannot get outside and that you will end up in a finite time into the singularity, so finite proper time. So these are things that one can deduce, but you cannot detect locally that you're traversing an horizon. There are some notions of horizons which are quasi-local that you can do some experiments here and say, oh, there is an isolated horizon here, or a non-expanding horizon. But these are not event horizon. So this is called, the event horizon. The only way to know if an event horizon is passing by is to go out to infinity and look backwards. Yeah.
So how do I see like something like black hole evaporating or something like that?
Okay, now this is an extremely there's no consensus on how to draw a diagram of an evaporating black hole. So that would be a very long conversation.
Because I somehow don't see the time dependence.
No. Exactly. So how you define an evaporating black hole is not a classical black hole. So there you need to do some approximation. So you need to say, at our timescales, this object is essentially a black hole. It looks like a black hole. So this might not be actual infinity. Could be some approximate notion of infinity. And then there is a diagram like this that kind of works, but if I wait long enough, this diagram loses its meaning because things will come out of an evaporating black hole eventually. So this diagram doesn't work. So what replaces it is it's a bit of a controversy, if you want.
And sort of black hole forming is also time dependent, right?
But yeah, but the black hole, the formation of a classical black hole has a diagram like this. It's completely regular in the past. There is some massive object moving along time-like trajectories. That's, this could be a shell that collapses. And at some point, it's dense enough to form a black hole. There is an horizon and so on. So this is fine for this type of diagram is fine for a classical black hole. OK, next. OK, so I know this is pretty rough and not super satisfactory, but let's take it for what it is. What I will need is to have a sense of what that diagram means for now. And the fact that the black hole, the event horizon is defined from infinity, that's an important thing to know. And the other thing that I will need is that it's a null surface by construction. So there is a theorem then by Carter and Hawking. Sometimes called a rigidity theorem. Which says the following. So we have a stationary. The input is a stationary black hole. A stationary black hole is a black hole with a time-like Killing vector field. So it means that it has stopped evolving, and from some point on in time, there is a Killing vector field, which is approximate in the past, of course, if it has formed, but towards the future, there is a time-like Killing vector field. So given this, what I get out is that it's axisymmetric, and this comes from the on-shell, of course. These are all on-shell statements because those spacetimes are on make sense only on-shell. So it's axisymmetric. I will comment on the time-like property in a moment, but leave it like this for now. There is a second Killing vector field, which is phi a, which is rotations now. And on top, there is a special one needs another technical hypothesis here, but with this technical hypothesis, there is a second there is a special Killing vector field. So there exists a constant omega h such that chi a plus these two. So this Killing vector field, which is a combination of those two, is is the vector field of the Killing horizon. So such that H, the horizon, is a Killing horizon for chi. OK, so somehow, if you have a stationary black hole, you have a Killing horizon. And then you can use the properties of these Killing horizons. So as I drew here, you see that chi is time-like outside, but not inside this horizon. So what when I mean a time-like Killing vector field is something that is time-like at infinity. It does not need to be time-like once you cross the horizon, because in general, it would not be the case. So these type of properties are close to infinity, and then so in the outer region essentially. Now the funny thing is that Killing, well, maybe. So this is how Killing horizon entered the theory of black holes. Now there is a very peculiar, there is a particular type of Killing horizons which are bifurcate Killing horizons. And the Rindler one is an example. So what happens in Rindler is that this is my horizon, but at this there is this special point. At some point, it intersects itself. So the way one defines this is as follows. A bifurcate Killing horizon . So we need two Killing horizons for same pi. So they have the same, they are associated to the same Killing vector field. And these two Killing horizons intersect at a codimension 2 surface. So let's say this is a 2 sphere. So it's this surface over here. So this is K1, this is K2, and this is C. And this is called the bifurcation surface. So if this is non-empty, it's called the bifurcation surface. Of course, it's not too hard to see, because here L is changing direction. So what is happening is that chi is equal to 0 at C. That this should make sense, because if chi becomes L and L is changing direction, the only way it can change direction continuously is that it vanishes. The interesting thing is more that the converse is also true. If there is a Killing vector field that vanishes as a codimension to surface, that surface is the bifurcation surface of a bifurcate Killing horizon. So I will not write it fully, but you see what it means, the converse. There is something that vanishes at the surface, then you get a bifurcate Killing horizon out of it. And here, we get the theorem that Jaroslav was pointing towards. This is Carter and Bardeen. Is known as the zeroth law. Sorry, do I miss? Okay, I should have said, well, doesn't matter. Kappa is constant on H. And I think more generally on any isolated horizon if the Einstein's equation hold, but definitely on H, which is what we care about. So this, the fact that this is constant on k is where one first starts seeing that there is an analogy between this kappa and the temperature of a thermalized system, because on a thermalized system, the temperature has to be constant by definition. And this kappa, the surface gravity, which was the acceleration of our Killing vector field at the horizon, this acceleration is constant everywhere. The surface gravity is constant everywhere. So in a sense, it's an intrinsic property of that surface. And we can think of it, we start seeing that there could be a parallel between a temperature and this quantity. Of course, it's completely heuristic, like that there's no other reason for now. It's not very deep, but it's just an observation. If that holds true, though, we see that, and then I will not state the theorem, but we see that there is we expect that situations where kappa is zero are special, are a little weird. Like a zero temperature system doesn't really exist. So there are theorems indeed that say that extremal black holes, which are those with zero surface gravity, are unstable, do not have nice mathematical properties. And so we can focus on those that have non-zero surface gravity. And I will start from there next. Sorry, let me just say kappa equals zero, unstable black hole. And as a reference, if you want to read about it, That's a mathematician who studies GR. Yes.
So they're unstable only in like flat space, or are they unstable also in like EDS or something?
I don't know about EDS. Yeah. He has a website where there is a nice blurb where he summarizes many results in words without going into technical details. So he might be saying something there. I don't know about EDS. Thanks.